From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Next hour, miracles happen with Dr. Brian Weiss. Here's what's happening. I've got a long list, a very big recall. I don't want you to get sick, so listen up. That New Mexico company has now expanded its recall of peanut butter and almond butter to include cashew butters, tahini, and blanched and roasted peanut products. Sunland Inc. sells its nuts and nut butters to large grocery stores and other food distributors all around the country. The company recalled products under multiple brand names after salmonella illnesses were linked to Trader Joe's creamy salted Valencia peanut butter. Now, that's one of the brands manufactured by Sunland. The Federal Center for Disease Control and Prevention said there are now 30 illnesses in 19 states that can be traced to the Trader Joe's peanut butter. No other foods have been linked to the illness yet, but Sunland has recalled other products manufactured on the same equipment as the Trader Joe's product. In addition to Trader Joe's, the recall includes nut products sold at Whole Foods Market, Target, Fresh and Easy, Giant Food, Harry and David, Stop and Shop, and several other stores. Now, here's some of the brand names. Archer Farms, Earth Balance, Fresh and Easy, Late July, Heinen's Josephs, Natural Value, Naturally More, Open Nature, Peanut Power Butter, Serious Food, Snack Light Power, Sprouts Farmers Market, Sprouts Sunland, and Dog's Butter, among others. Their recall includes 101 products. Several retailers have issued additional recalls. What a mess. And an epidemic of a deadly strain of salmonella has now swept across the whole of Africa by taking advantage of the spread of the HIV, according to a team of international researchers. They say weakened immune systems caused by HIV allowed it to spread. One in four people in Africa infected with the strain die. Food safety expert Jeff Nelkin with us. Jeff, first of all, quick story on this peanut butter recall. This is huge. How does peanut butter get salmonella?
Well, again, you know, in the past, we found peanuts that were not being processed correctly. The facilities had issues where the ceilings were compromised. There could have been, dirt being brought into the preparation area. So we haven't gotten down to the bottom of the investigation yet. So, again, it's premature to say why, but you can see how widespread this is.
And this deadly strain of salmonella in Africa, taking advantage of people with HIV, lowered immune systems. Salmonella itself, I mean, how bad does it get?
Well, this is a new situation because basically for the last 30, 40 years, you're talking about a continent that's been ravaged by HIV. And what they're finding is not only that the salmonella specifically mutated, but the population is, you know, compromised. The immunity system is very low in these folks. So they didn't realize that all of a sudden that this was a specific mutation that had taken place. Before, they just thought it was the general situation that was occurring.
And cottage law passing in California, what's that mean here, Jeff?
Oh, very good. This was a law that was just signed in a couple of days ago, and what it means is that people will be preparing foods from their homes and selling them outside to restaurants.
Ooh.
So truly, when you see homemade on the menu, it may not be the restaurant, but it may have been made in somebody's home.
Do they have to get a license to do this?
This is all being discussed right now, how they are going to go about monitoring and educating people that potentially are involved, because obviously the health department does not go into people's homes to verify how they're preparing these products.
Okay, Jeff's website, foodsafetycoach.com. Now, here's a story that broke in the Daily Mail. It's out of the United Kingdom. Russia has apparently suspended the import and use of American GM, genetically modified corn, following a study suggesting a link to breast cancer and organ damage. Separately, the European Food Safety Authority has now ordered its own review in its research, which was conducted by a French university. This decision by Russia could be followed by other nations and what would be a severe blow to the take-up of the controversial technology. Unfortunately, they've taken most of the natural seeds away, so I think we'd be stuck anyway. and a genetically modified cow that produces milk less likely to cause allergic reactions has been engineered by New Zealand scientists. Up to 3% of infants are allergic to cow's milk in the very first year of life. The modified cow produced milk without the beta-lactoglobulin, which is a whey product to which some people are allergic. The study has been labeled a milestone by one scientist, but campaign group says it raises huge ethical concerns. And in Kentucky, a Chinese restaurant there has reportedly been forced to shut its doors after apparently serving up roadkill. The restaurant in Williamsburg was shut down after a customer called the health department when he saw a dead deer being wheeled into the kitchen. Oh. The manufacturing sector expanded in September. Good news, shaking off 3 months of weakness as new orders and employment picked up. Catherine Austin Fitz with us. Catherine, this does sound like good news, doesn't it?
Well, there is good news, George, particularly with quantitative easing. It'll pick up activity in a variety of areas. The economy is very spotty. You have areas, if you're in oil and gas, if you're in advanced technology, if you're in food and water, you're probably going gangbusters. Whereas if you're in any of the areas that are being globalized or automated, you're hurting. So it's very spotty because, as I said before, we have a world that's being born and a world that's dying, and the change is accelerating. We just saw Jerry Brown in California sign a new bill saying that self-driven cars without drivers could start hitting the California highways in 2015.
That will be strange.
Imagine what that's going to do to taxi cab drivers.
Strange indeed. Catherine, what's new with Solari.com?
Well, we just instituted a new equity report. We're doing the first. We're going to do one a quarter on the equity markets. We're doing the first one this week. So it's a lot happening. We're very busy, and I'm out in California and loving it, except, George, it got so hot today.
Yeah, it is. It's too hot for October, isn't it?
I know. What happened to sweater weather?
I know it. Not here. Not here yet, but it'll come. Hey, American Express will refund $85 million to customers to settle regulators' accusations that it charged unlawful late fees and deceive customers to pressure them to pay off old debts or buy extra credit card services. Moonlight scares bats into hiding in the shadows, according to new research. Scientists in Mexico collated studies of bat behavior from all over the world and analyzed them for evidence of lunar phobia or fear of the moon. The study found that the activity of bats in moonlit habitats decreased on bright nights compared with bats that live and forge around in darker places. And how about this? You want to improve your concentration? Take a look at pictures of adorable babies and animals like puppies. That, according to a new study, it will increase your ability to focus. A NASA spacecraft has just beamed back a beautiful song sung by our planet. It's called Chorus, according to Craig Kletzing of the University of Iowa, saying that this is one of the clearest examples we've ever heard. That's good old planet Earth singing away. Chorus is an electromagnetic phenomenon caused by plasma waves in Earth's radiation belt. And the universe as we know it may be a simulation created by programmers from the future, according to a NASA scientist. We're going to talk with Sir Charles Schulz III about this and some other stories next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie. As I mentioned, a NASA scientist says the universe might have been simulated, created by programmers from the future. Well, of course, Sir Charles Schulz worked at Martin Marietta Aerospace for 10 years on weapons systems, comes on the program quite a bit as we talk about a fossil hunter's guide to Mars and the living galaxy. We're going to talk about some science issues this hour. Sir Charles, welcome back. How are you?
Doing very well, George. Thank you for inviting me on the show.
So is it possible programmers from the future really simulated the universe and none of this is real?
Well, that raises a lot of very interesting questions. Just a few months back, I was reading some reports about the Harvard-Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics and a group there that created a simulation of our universe. And it was able to show the formation of galaxies and structures we couldn't explain otherwise very easily. So it's not out of the question that our universe could be a simulation. And the question is, if it were, how would we find out? It would be difficult, wouldn't it?
It sure would. I'm not going to complain. I just hope they don't shut the program down on us.
Well, no, and that could be a real problem. I hope they have very good backup in other systems as well. But, you know, look at video games that we've developed in the recent last 2 or 3 years and how detailed they're becoming. And it doesn't take a lot of imagination to think that if we were to take the step of quantum computing, we could make those games so realistic they could compete with reality. So, again, it's not out of the question with quantum computing technology, we could create a world just as detailed as our own. And that seems to be counterintuitive. But it actually is a very realistic possibility, and we're seeing the beginnings of that technology now. So, you know, it's a fascinating question. I don't know about the issue of somebody from the future doing something like that. I think it would be more likely that somebody other than us had created the simulation if the universe was a simulation.
What's new with you these days, Charles?
Staying very busy in research and actually having a great deal of fun and learning a lot of great things. I have a small farm. We've been doing a lot of work there and making some real advancements in how we're living out here. So I'm having a great time.
Catherine Austin Fitz just mentioned, have you seen that story about robotic cars will take to the streets in California?
Oh, absolutely. You know, Google's been doing it for quite a while. Laws are being put in place in California to allow robotic vehicles, self-driving cars, to operate on the roads. And they've just passed a law that mandates that the groundwork be allowed on this very soon, and they expect, Sergey Brin of Google says he expects the automated car to be common and available in 5 years. But the new law that's just been passed in California makes their Department of Motor Vehicles have to draft regulations by January 1st of 2015, and it's going to define the regulations and safety measures that have to be put in place. Now, it's already legal for some of them to operate, and the funny thing is California isn't the first state to do this. It's actually already been done. Nevada did it earlier in this year.
Yep.
Florida has some laws in place, and Arizona, Hawaii, and Oklahoma apparently are also looking at it. And you know what's really interesting is the potential it has. There are stay-at-home people who can't drive or people who don't have licenses. So the infirm and the elderly, for instance, would benefit. But it also means that freight lines and delivery companies and taxi services could be replaced by automation, and this could have some upsides and some downsides, as you can imagine. I know that long-distance freight companies years ago were looking at routes driven by machines rather than drivers who were too tired, and the sleepy or distracted drivers cause a fair number of accidents.
Could you see people in New York trying to hail a cab that has no driver?
Well, you know, I think a lot of people who watch science fiction have read about, seen this thing, and it's not out of the question. And, you know, it actually is right around the corner for us.
Well, it is. Now, how does this work? How do robotic cars work on the streets?
Well, it's a combination of many technologies. The obvious solution is GPS to know where you are, just like any of the navigation systems we can buy. And the other addition is a vision system that allows the car to recognize the changing of lights, the presence of vehicles and obstacles such as pedestrians, but realize many of these vehicles are automated driving on the highways where there are less opportunities for foot traffic. The ones that operate within populated areas have to be far more complex, and you can see that from the litigation standpoint alone, it's going to change the way we look at law. I think it's quite possible we would have a whole class of people in society that don't need a driver's license to get to work anymore, but we also get a new class of law practice where the responsibility for some of the accidents could land in the lap of a computer programmer.
I guess you couldn't drive home drunk anymore.
Well, and that's one of the very positive statements, that you actually would be able to get anywhere regardless of your state, given nothing but a credit card, perhaps.
Yeah, you just simply say, I wasn't driving.
Well, you know, Google has a fleet of modified, mostly Priuses, and they've got over 300,000 miles of driving time on them with state roads right now.
Can you trust it, though? What happens if something goes down with the GPS system or something?
Well,
you can have massive accidents?
That is a very interesting point. We live in a society where many of the things we do depends on GPS, and it is also known that the military and other agencies have the ability to scramble the GPS signal under certain conditions. So you have to have a backup system, and one of the things that they have done is because of the fact that GPS is inherently not terribly accurate. So they use a local time signal, a radio signal, that establishes a known marker position, and they mix it with other signals, including GPS, to increase the accuracy to the point where it can be down to the inch. So there would be many other systems in place rather than simply GPS. And with enough backup electronics and enough backup systems, there could be a safety factor that would be far greater than any human operator. We can at least hope so.
Would you like to drive on the streets knowing that there are robotic cars out there?
I think that I would always like to have my hands on the wheel and my eyes on the road. And the opportunity to relax a little is a nice thought, particularly if you have a lot of things you want to do or if you've had a tough day. I think a lot of people could lay back, listen to some music, or read a book.
Go to sleep.
Yes, but, you know, there's always going to be that nagging thought. All of us driving a vehicle of that sort and growing up in the era before the computer was commonplace, I think we'll always have that funny feeling, you know, something could go wrong.
Yeah, what if you get a car like Christine in Stephen King's movies and it does its own thing?
Well, you know, that could be the result of a really mean programmer.
Well, that could be too. Well, you know what? Now, you've just brought up an interesting point. What if somebody tries to sabotage everybody by doing that?
Well, understand that just about 3 years ago, it was discovered that many of the drive-by-wire systems of the new vehicles, and Toyota was mentioned in this particular study, could be taken over quite easily. There was a college group of students who came together and figured a few hacks out that allowed them to send overriding control signals to drive-by-wire vehicles to take over the brakes, to make a single wheel lock at command, to make the engine turn off, to make it increase and accelerate without the user's control. So we have a very substantial body of issues to confront when we look at cyber attacks and automated vehicles.
What's also new, Charles, in the world of science? What's out there?
Something that you'll find very interesting, the eternal clock.
Now, what is that?
Some scientists have figured out how to build a clock that theoretically should last beyond the end of the universe. Now, the original idea was proposed by Nobel laureate Frank Wilczek. And his idea was, instead of creating a crystal like you'd find the quartz crystal in your watch to be, he would create a crystal that was four-dimensional. And it was just a short period of time before California's Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratories came up with a way to do it. A fellow by the name of Xiang Zhang, a researcher at Berkeley, his name is Xiang Zhang,
okay.
And yes, that could be a tongue twister, designed a method of trapping atoms so they rotate in a field of electrostatic charge. And the way they rotate, the time of the atom's movement overlaps in the fourth dimension to create a crystal that theoretically could last forever. And it, once it begins rotating, it doesn't change its energy level, and so it should last past the end of the universe if it can be done. So they're going to be actually trying to build one of these things in just a few months. I mean, consider a crystal. A crystal is basically a repeating or periodic structure, but it's made of three-dimensional atoms. This is a periodic structure that stretches in time as well as solid matter.
You see where the next evolution of phones might be paper thin?
Yes. In fact, they have printable electronics right now and flexible electronics, so it's a very short leap to make a phone so thin and actually flexible that it can be put in your pocket or rolled up. You may remember just a few years ago they came up with flat displays that could be rolled up. And so, again, the progress in electronics has been phenomenal, and what has really set it off is nanomaterials and flexible semiconductors, and that brings us to even more material. They have recently come up with not just flexible cell phones, but the ability to create electronics that can be injected in the body, and over a period of time, they will dissolve.
Yeah, they'll search out where they're going, correct the problem in your body, and then just fade away.
That's correct, and the way they do it is they make the circuitry of very, very thin silicon, and they make the wiring of magnesium metal. Now, both of those materials are present in your body in small traces, and the normal action of the fluids in your body will dissolve them. So how do you make it last long enough to be effective? They coat it in silk. Silk is used in many medical procedures.
It's amazing.
It's basically neutral in the body, and it can be built in such a way that it has a lifespan that they know from hours to days to weeks before it breaks down. And once the silk breaks down, the protection for the circuit is gone, and then it begins to dissolve and it doesn't leave a trace behind. And the idea is the circuitry is about 20 nanometers thick. That's about 20 billionths of a meter. Think about 200 atoms. And that's extremely thin. And they have thought about using this for implanted sensors in the body to control the release of medications, and even to create a fever locally to destroy organisms that might be living in your body, such as bacteria. And DARPA funded this, and they've come up with at least two ways of powering it already. One would be wireless power, and the other is to be powered by the chemistry of your body itself.
They're going to try to trick us, though, and put chips in us, Charles. I know it.
Well, that doesn't even have to be a trick right now, because the FDA recently approved the use of RFID and other circuitry in pills. This was just a couple of months ago.
It never stops. Hold on, Charles. We're going to take this quick break. We'll come back with phone calls and questions for you as we talk about science this hour on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back with Sir Charles Schulz III. Sir Charles, before we take calls, what's new out there on Mars?
You know, they've been showing a lot of rocks that show the erosion from a flow of a body of water. And it says very much that there was a river not too long ago flowing over the rocks that they found in Gale Crater. So they consider this the first solid proof that there was liquid water flowing on the surface of Mars. I think that a lot of people have better opinions than that about it, but they are very confident they've discovered excellent traces of the flow of water in not too distant times on the surface of Mars with the Curiosity rover at this point.
What do you think happened to all that water, Charles?
Well, basically, it's a change in the climate, and of course, the atmosphere is very thin. Personally, the evidence I see tells me that the planet's in an ice age, and in many cases that they've landed on areas where the ice is just under a very thin layer of soil, and that can be seen in many of the orbital pictures they've taken.
If it thawed out, would there be oceans there?
It's calculated that what they know already is there's enough to cover most of the planet in about 50 meters of water, and there's a field of glaciers on the equator of Mars that's less than 5 million years old.
Wow. So how hot would the planet have to get in order to start melting all that?
You know, another 15 or 20 degrees would probably be enough to do the process, because the polar caps where the dry ice snow is would begin to vaporize and thicken the atmosphere, and then it would be just like a ball rolling down the hill.
Well,
the process would accelerate.
With a minimal atmosphere, that kind of degree pop is possible, isn't it?
It certainly is. Right now, CO2 in the atmosphere contributes about 20 degrees of greenhouse effect warming to the planet as it stands.
So if the oceans came by thawing, could they then create an atmosphere on Mars?
Well, the atmosphere that would be there would be 2 to 3 times thicker than what's presently there,
right,
just from the CO2 and the polar caps becoming a part of the atmosphere. But it would definitely add more water. But the paradoxical thing is, right now, the atmosphere of water of Mars contains 10 times more moisture than in theory it should. So if it were to become a thicker atmosphere, the atmospheric moisture actually would drop as the conditions change.
Interesting. Okay, now let's go to calls. We'll go to William in Jacksonville, Florida, east of the Rockies. William, go ahead.
Yes, I have a quick question.
Sure.
Actually, I got two of them, if it's okay to ask them. But the first one is does he know anything about the human-animal hybridization program that they were doing over in Japan? And the second one was if he knows anything about the immortality gene that they did a report on about close to 10 years ago.
Yes, actually, I'll cover the immortality gene issue first. There is actually a chemical that can be produced by our genes called telomerase, and it prevents a cell from dying. Cells reproduce, and every time they reproduce, the telomeres, the hardware that separates the chromosomes, gets a little shorter. And so after a certain number of programmed divisions, the cells die. Telomerase is a gene that can be turned on that prevents that from happening, and the cells can effectively live forever. There has been some study, and I don't know exactly where it is at this point, but there have been very promising signs that it could be used to extend our lives effectively, indefinitely, if we weren't damaged. As far as the hybrid program, I don't know the state of it at this moment, but I do know that chimeras or hybrids using some human and some animal genes were done for studies. Now, I do not see any evidence they'd taken anything close to a development stage like term. And the problem is many of them show problems in development that wouldn't allow them to become successful organisms, but they were used in genetic studies to see what sort of structures were generated, the actions of proteins and enzymes.
There's been talk, Charles, that they might have created about 150 human-animal hybrid embryos in laboratories. I don't know how true that is. I don't know if that's sci-fi or what.
Well, it's easily done, but the problem is most of the time you end up with something that would self-abort, and that happens in the human body all the time. Many women undergo a pregnancy that aborts itself if there's a certain amount of genetic damage in the growth process, and it happens automatically. So in many of these studies, they will hybridize a cell, have it go through 2, 3, or 4 divisions, and study what results, and then they will terminate it.
Gosh, I would hate for this to happen, though.
Well, I think there's a lot of moral issues involved there.
Oh, yeah, huge. Elaine in Waterford, Connecticut, first-time caller. Good morning, Elaine.
Yes, I'm, I must be on the wrong line. I'm not a first-time caller.
No, you're not. Shame on you.
I know. I just, because I have it on auto dial.
That's all right.
But anyway.
I'll let you stay.
The guest was talking about all these ways of improving timekeeping and, you know, extending all these clocks or whatever with crystals and so forth. I live in a town with a nuclear power plant, this Millstone.
All right.
And as best I know, they still run on a backup with a diesel engine, which only lasts a couple of days should something happen.
That's right.
I also happen to live across from a nuclear sub base, so I'm really in it. But that's neither here nor there. But I'm thinking, if they can do all these things with clocks, can't they do something with helping out with the nuclear?
I think it takes up too much power, Charles. What do you think?
Well, the issue with the crystals, the time clock crystals, is that they consume no power at all once they're made. With nuclear power plants and backing up the amount of energy you need, a crystal isn't the solution because it basically is a passive device. It doesn't create any power or store any power in any way that we have any access to at this point. People are working on crystalline storage in the forms that would store, let's say, hydrogen material. And some fuels can be stored in a crystal that's even made of plastic, a very lightweight method. But something that I saw very recently, the storage of hydrogen can be done using feathers. They take chicken feathers, and they cut the quill out of the middle. They place the feathers in a chamber and heat them up to about 1,500 degrees, and it carbonizes them. And the carbon that comes out has a huge amount of surface area and can store an incredible amount of hydrogen very, very easily without high pressures. So, you know, there's always hope for finding a way to store energy sources, and this is one of them.
Time travel? You think it'll ever be possible?
I think that it's possible, but I think that it's not going to be the way people think. Many people consider a time vehicle such as the DeLorean in Back to the Future, something you hop in and you drive to a destination. But the real solution to time travel is probably going to be more like a wormhole. And if you were capable of creating a wormhole, a bridge from one point in space to another, and you were to place one in a spaceship, let's say, and make it travel very, very rapidly near the speed of light for a period of time and bring it back, then the two ends would be at two different points in time, and stepping through the hole one way or the other would send you backward or forward a fixed distance into the future or the past. Real time travel would probably be more in that form.
Let's go to Tom in Stockton, California, west of the Rockies. Hey, Tom, go ahead.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call, George. I had an original question, and during listening to the program, I had another one. Should I ask them both?
Go ahead. We've got some time for you.
Okay. The original one, I believe you mentioned a chip that's placed in the body. I didn't know that it has an electrical energy that's self-contained or uses electrical energy. But anyway, my question was that most things have an atomical structure. And immediately surrounding the nucleus of an atom, there's this force called the Coulomb force. It's usually a repelling force, and anything entering that force field is usually repelled with a high amount of energy. I don't know, you know, if that would have any application. My second question, I'll try to make it quick. I've kind of heard about this before about the telomeres. What I don't really understand about that is that, nature doesn't maintain things in its prime. The telomeres, I said that if you have an active form of telomeres, that it eventually becomes cancer, that is, you know, the essence of cancer, that the cells are just going to keep dividing as opposed to renewing themselves. That, I never understood that concept that it's a renewal, this immortality, you know, that by making the telomeres, you know, active, that, you know, I don't see that how that that would accomplish that. And thank you very much.
Okay. You want to comment on any of that, Charles?
Sure. The first one about the Coulomb force. The Coulomb force is the name for the electrostatic repulsion around the nucleus of any atom. Every nucleus of every atom is positively charged. And so when you try to bring two of them together, they have the same charge and they repel each other, kind of like the wrong poles of the magnet. and it's a very powerful repulsive force, and that's what keeps everything in the universe stable right now. We do have ways around it, such as very high temperatures, very high pressures or velocities, and that's what makes the sun and the other stars glow. It's not really a mystery, it's just an electrostatic charge, and it's very powerful the closer you get to it. So that's why atoms are stable. As far as the immortality issue, all of our cells have a program in them that keeps them on track, and one of the problems we would encounter when trying to activate the immortality gene is that we would want to make certain that the cells don't grow out of control. And when that happens, that is cancer. That is a form of cancer.
That's right.
So cancer cells were where we found this gene because they turn it on and use it to grow out of control. And yet when they used telomerase to treat healthy tissue, they did not find it growing out of control. So the issue is cancer cells already have a problem, and that's why they grow out of control.
One day they'll cure that.
Yes, they will.
One day. Let's go to John in Pocatello, Idaho. Hey, John, go ahead.
Hey, greetings, man. It's a pleasure. A long-time listener. I had a question,
thank you,
George. You mentioned something earlier before your guest came on, I believe, or you might have been there, talking about a chip. And my question for your screener before I got on the air was, it seems like the society nowadays, I won't name any businesses, but you can go in any grocery store. It seems like they have a lot of self-serve checkout that they're trying to initiate. And it seems to me that the mark of the beast is right around the corner. And I wanted to ask your guest, with the technology that we have nowadays, considering with moon and going to the moon and everything else, how far away would his estimation be that where the mark of the beast is really a reality where we have to get that chip to buy or sell? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Okay.
You know, there's a lot of controversy about that. And what we were speaking about, the FDA approving RFID in pills, is actually seen by many people as the beginnings of that, the precursors of that. It's not hard to imagine that the same sort of technology that could keep track of whether you're using your medicine properly could also be used to keep track of your movement. And this has been a concern of privacy advocates for many years. And then there's another small step to remove carrying a credit card, just as they remove the carrying of cash to use a bank card, to go to a system that reads your RFID chip and does all your transactions for you. And that's a very scary prospect because you literally would be at the mercy of the system at any time. Your finances could be turned off with the flip of a switch or the command to a computer.
Charles, what powers these chips?
There are many ways of powering them. A common one is to induce a pulse of magnetism. And it picks up that little pulse, and that powers the chip long enough for it to do its job and then shut down. It has a little capacitor inside that holds a bit of charge. Another way is some of them can be powered by blood chemistry. We have a device that takes the glucose from your bloodstream and literally runs a battery inside your body. And others will work as well. They have, I'd say, about six different technologies that are viable for powering a chip inside your body without having to put a battery inside it.
Well, if they put batteries inside of it, would they last longer?
You know, a very tiny device doesn't eat much power.
No.
Think about how long a lithium battery acts in a calculator. 5 years or better sometimes. So in the case where you have a very small device that normally is quite passive and only sends a signal once in a while, it could last, for years, very easily.
A long time. Let's go back to the phones. We'll go to, Marshall in Yellow Springs, Ohio. Hey, Marshall, thanks for calling.
Hi, how are you?
Good, Marshall.
Being kind of like Jeopardy here and phrase my comment in form of a question.
Okay.
Why didn't your guest know, if he's familiar with the Twins Paradox, that a particular example of time travel, which was formulated by Kip Thorne, I believe in 1988, wouldn't work?
Well, I'm not sure why it wouldn't work. If you could move a spaceship near the speed of light, and you had a pair of twins, and one stayed at home and one was in the spacecraft, if he were to travel near the speed of light, and it wouldn't really matter where he went, the period of time spent at very high speeds slows his aging process. And actually, we have a number of very good records that show that it could work based on what happens in particle accelerators. If we have a particle traveling at very high speeds in a particle accelerator, and it normally would break down in a few billionths of a second, we literally can slow it down so it lasts for thousands of times longer. So we have very good evidence right now And Kip Thorne is a very smart fellow. He knows a great deal about gravitation and space-time. And I've got a couple of books that he's written. And there is every indication that the twins paradox could work. So I would like to see any sort of information that would prove otherwise. It's a pretty essential part of relativity, actually.
Robert is west of the Rockies in California. Robert, go ahead.
Yes, good evening, Charles. Glad to hear from you.
Yes.
Good thing. Go ahead.
Yes, Charles.
Yes.
Yes, in regards to these driverless cars, what happens if it blows a tire out on the freeway?
Yeah, that's a great question.
That is the best question.
It's one of the best questions I've heard. Everybody assumes that the machinery is going to work perfectly. Pretty much whenever we have a tire blow, we would try to have cars that would respond in as safe a manner, and one would be anti-lock braking, one would be some means of perhaps slowing it and pulling it off to the side of the road very quickly. But it's going to be pretty much the same sort of a response a human being would have, just more safely executed.
Would they put an emergency system in the car where it has the ability to send a signal to the other cars and they just kind of stop while this one kind of like limps over to the side of the road?
That's a very good idea, and it's the same sort of thing that, people or insects or animals do when somebody's injured. They usually try to get out of the way or help. And if all the vehicles on the road were automated, that could be easily implemented. Yes, that would be an excellent solution.
Like the emergency beep or something.
Certainly.
Let's go to Roger in Alabama, first-time caller. Roger, let's get you in here real fast.
Okay. Obama's trying to push for this, getting this debt up so high so we'd have nowhere to fall to get an answer for our debt. So I guess go to that one world, new world order.
Well, that's going to happen. The debt load is way too high, Charles. You're not into all of that, but something's got to give.
Well, if the world owes so much money, who do they owe it to?
Themselves.
Oh, and that reminds me, there was one other technology I wanted to bring up briefly, if we've got a moment.
Yeah, I've got a minute. Go ahead.
Okay, and it's the space elevator. I know a lot of people have heard about the space elevator project. Well, it's got a little new life in it.
It's got some legs now?
Yes, it does. Michael Lane, who's the president of Liftport, began a Kickstarter project, and I don't know if you're familiar with Kickstarter.
Oh, sure. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. My buddy Mark Sapri raised some money on that for a movie they're doing.
Well, that's excellent. Since 2009, Kickstarter's connected over $350 million to projects in need of funding.
Yeah, it's
so
amazing.
It's a great way to go. Well, Liftport decided to go to Kickstarter and raise about $8,000 and train some interns and volunteers. And the amazing thing was the response they had was so large. They raised over $110,000.
That's almost enough to build the elevator.
Well,
not quite.
Well, but the scale of it is pretty breathtaking when you think about how little he was looking for. And the idea is to build a lunar space elevator, one that will allow people to get to the moon's surface very easily and to do it without having to use rocketry for landing and takeoff.
You mean from the Earth to the moon in an elevator?
No, actually, it would be from a point not far from the Earth down to the lunar surface. So we would only have to travel about 100,000 kilometers or about 60,000 miles, and we would be able to reach the end of the space elevator tether and carry us the rest of the way, the other 180,000 miles.
How strange. It could work, couldn't it?
Well, it certainly could. The materials are there, and the technology is being developed, and so they expect to have the system operating before the end of the decade if they get the rest of their
funding. All right. Thank you so much, Sir Charles Schulz. Up next, Dr. Brian Weiss joins us. His latest work, Miracles Happen. Stand by. Dr. Brian Weiss next on Coast to Coast AM.